Hello and welcome to Old Man Sailing. I'm John Passmore and speaking to you from the Caribbean. I'm in Antigua, where I'm up against the dock because we have a little bit of engine trouble, a sludge in the diesel tank. So it is entirely appropriate that we begin this week's podcast with the experts. It's a delicate decision when to call in the experts. A couple of weeks ago, I had this weird problem with the cooling water for the engine. Sometimes it would flow, sometimes it wouldn't. There seemed to be no logic to it. I'd inspected the filter, tested the seacock, easy now that I have a seawater pump in the galley branching off the inlet. I opened up the impeller housing without dropping any of the bolts into the bilge. I even asked for advice on Facebook, and terrified myself with the range of wild and technical advice that came back. In the end, I pulled into Dover, where I met a lovely engineer called Mick. He was one of those calm and competent tradesmen who takes the cack-handed boat owner under his wing with a show of mock exasperation at the vagaries of machinery. He didn't even bring his toolbox onto the boat, just climbed aboard and said, "Let's have a look." And the next thing he said was, "Hello, what's this branch coming off the inlet pipe?" "Ah," says I proudly, "that's my galley seawater." We worked out, or at least he was kind enough to include me in the process, that under certain circumstances, motor sailing on starboard tack, for instance, the engine would rather draw air from the galley pump rather than water from the sea. All you have to do is put your thumb over the tap for a minute to make it see sense. I felt such a fool. Mainly, I felt furious with myself for incurring another bill on the maintenance budget when all I needed to do was to think logically. What is it marine engineers charge? £50 an hour? 60? But Mick shook his head. He hadn't even opened his toolbox, had he? And now here I am in Falmouth, with the headsail furling gear working as smoothly as if it was the demonstration model on the hood stand at the boat show. That's not how it was yesterday. Yesterday I couldn't get the last two turns off it, and I had to put the line on the winch to roll it up again. Twice I dropped the sail and fiddled with the drum. Everything was fine without the sail. It had to be something to do with the new furling line. On the other hand, the gear had worked to begin with. Only after Portland did things start to go wrong. Yet here I was, ready to set out into the Atlantic. The rigger was called Jake. He would come and have a look when he'd finished with the davits on the brand new Rustler 57. I went and found the boat. It was easy to see why this one took priority. For one thing, all the sail handling was electric, or possibly hydraulic. There was a satellite dish, a drop-down bathing platform. The varnish on the rail looked as if it belonged in Harrod's furniture department. I looked back up the pontoon to where Samsara lay with her hand-painted decks and the rust stain dripping out from some ancient fastening buried under the woodwork. How could I take Jake away from his gleaming davits? The rib, by the way, came with individually fitted canvas covers to keep the sun off the various bits without increasing the windage with an all-over cover. Nice idea. And yet, Jake took a break from this million-pound project to come and look at my furling gear. He didn't bring a toolbox either, just a big leather man, and borrowed my 10mm socket spanner and an Allen key. Here's what he found. And if you ever need to change the furling line on a Seafurl 5, you need to know this. Inside the drum housing, there is a plastic disc which separates into two halves. When you put it back together, it needs to click into a groove in the extrusion. Nothing to it, really. But, of course, enough to stop the whole thing working and lead to all kinds of potential disasters. I could have worked that out, I said to the back of his head as we crouched on the foredeck and he tightened the last screws. Actually, I'm not sure that's entirely true. Already I'd put it back together again once without noticing the groove. The truth is, it's the tradesman's expertise that you pay for, not his time. So how much did I owe Jake for his 10 minutes? He shook his head and smiled as he headed back to what he called the tweaking at the other end of the pontoon. I peeked at the online brochure for the new boat. It's got a heated towel rail in the heads. I bet they won't get that fixed for nothing. Old men don't use spinnaker squeezers. Years and years ago, I wrote a piece for Yachting World called Real Men Don't Use Spinnaker Squeezers. It centred around the mother of all brooches in Largo off the Grand Banks towards the end of the 1988 O-Star, which that year was sponsored by Carlsberg, although the beer was all gone before we left Plymouth. There were two particular features of this brooch which remain stuck fast in the memory. One was that it all happened in the middle of the most inky black night, but the spinnaker sheet popped the life buoy out of its bracket, dragging the strobe light with it, which of course started flashing, lighting up the entire scene in a series of frozen images, the myriad droplets of Atlantic fixed in time and space. And while all this was going on, the cockpit speakers continued to play, relentlessly, Maurice Chevalier singing "Thank Heaven for Little Girls." All of this comes to mind because I dared to suggest on Facebook that traditional symmetrical spinnakers were a lot more versatile than cruising chutes and asymmetric spinnakers. Back in 1988, the asymmetric version had only just been invented and was strictly the preserve of racing sailors. The rest of us had the old-fashioned kind and pulled it out. Occasionally, it ended up in the water. That was the way it was. We thought nothing of it. Yet now, people seem to be horrified at the idea of flying a traditional spinnaker. Samsara came with a cruising chute. I swapped it for what I would call a proper one, with a man who had never taken it out of his attic and had been warned by the previous owner that it was a monster. No, it isn't. It's a pussycat. Pussycat with a lot of oomph, admittedly. The other day it had me doing 7 knots hour after hour on the way from Valencia to Galway across the centre of a tropical low, while everyone else from Bloody Fallen to Roach's Point was sheltering from gales. But then proper symmetrical spinnakers are absolutely great sails. The enduring image of Jean-Luc Van den Heed winning the Golden Globe race is of Matmut running into Les Sables d'Olonne behind her big blue kite with the sponsors named to the fore. How did Matmut's PR department organise that? VDH is even older than me. Maybe flying a proper spinnaker is an age thing, in which case it is something which old man sailing should seek out to preserve for posterity, like baggy wrinkle and futtock shrouds. So here's where I maintain that a symmetrical spinnaker scores over the asymmetric upstart. It's more versatile. You can fly it with the wind anywhere from dead astern, or even a bit more, to 10 degrees forward of the beam. That's 100 degrees of apparent wind angle. Try doing that with a cruising chute, and the main will blanket it once the wind gets past the quarter. Asymmetrics on bowsprits don't fare much better. In fact, they really only come into their own when the boat is fast enough to shift the apparent wind so far forward that they never really run at all. So much for the technical side. How about the fear factor? For that's the real issue. When it comes to sailing nightmares, the spinnaker wrap is right up there along with hitting the container and the out-of-season hurricane, lightning strikes and piracy. And it's a legitimate fear. Once your pretty sail is wrapped a couple of times round the forestay, when you just happen to be passing a wind farm or the south coast of Jersey or one of those trawlers that keep relentlessly and rightfully to their course, you are, without doubt, in the deep stuff. I just looked and there is no advice whatsoever on the internet about how to deal with a spinnaker wrap. There's plenty about how to avoid it before it happens, but absolutely nothing about what to do when it does. I suppose this is because there is really nothing you can do, short of sending someone aloft with a sharp knife. It's either that or wait till the wind drops. To prove this point, I remember one of the ASAP competitors sailing back into Falmouth with 3 metres of spinnaker still flying from his masthead. He had managed the outward trip single-handed and without incident. For the return leg, his wife shipped aboard, but flatly refused to let him go up the mast to retrieve the sail. I don't believe they've sailed together since. In fact, I'm not even sure they're still married. Anyway, to business. Here is the old man's recipe for flying a traditional spinnaker single-handed and safely. First, before you do anything else, hoist the spinnaker net. You can make this yourself. It's just 2 3-millimeter lines hoisted on a spare halyard. One line clips to the stem head fitting just after the furling gear, and the other to the foot of the mast. And between these two, run 3 shorter lengths of line at intervals to form a net. Once this is up, it is impossible for anything to wrap itself round the forestay. My net has clips on one end of the horizontal lines, and I attach them as I hoist it. Makes it less prone to tangles. Then rig your sheets and guys, if they aren't a permanent fixture. Sheets go to blocks on the quarters, the guys to the blocks on the boat's widest point. And if your boat is shaped like a dart and the widest point is at the stern, then you will have a bowsprit and an asymmetric spinnaker, and none of this applies. On each side, the guy and the sheet terminate in a single snap shackle. Once you've got all that sorted, you can furl your headsail. Take the spinnaker halyard round the foresay to the lee side and clip to the guardrail. Rig the pole on the windward side with the spinnaker guy through the down-facing jaw and pulled in front of the forestay and clip to the leeward side of the pulpit. You will need 2 uphauls for the pole, one on each side, otherwise you won't be able to jibe it with the net up. The downhaul can be taken through a block in the centre of the foredeck and led back to the cockpit. Bring up the spinnaker and attach the guy and sheet. Ensure the line for the squeezer is not tangled and kept inside everything else. This line should run through some sort of ring which can be attached to a point in the middle of the foredeck. You don't want to worry about losing it. Go back to the cockpit and pull in the guy so that the clew of the sail is dragged round to the weather side. Leave enough slack in the sheet so that the sail will not fill immediately. You don't want to be pitched off the foredeck when it suddenly inflates with a bang. Make up the pole downhaul in the cockpit. Once all this is ready, attach the halyard and hoist the sail in its squeezer. Hoist the squeezer and make fast the line around the foredeck cleat to stop the funnel slipping down if the wind drops. Go back to the cockpit and haul on the sheet. Adjust the guy and pole downhaul, and off you go. Writing it all down like this makes everything sound rather complicated, which I suppose it is when compared to hoisting a cruising chute, but really it's just a matter of remembering everything and doing it in the right order, and, of course, practicing until you can run through the whole process in 10 minutes. One other thing to mention, particularly for single-handers, is that I have never managed to make a mechanical wind vane steer a spinnaker. As soon as there is a puff of wind and the boat accelerates, the apparent wind angle moves forward, throwing everything out of kilter. An electronic autopilot works fine, but I would love to know how the Golden Globe guys did it. Meanwhile, a couple of things to mention about taking your spinnaker down again. Firstly, douse it as soon as the autopilot loses control. Okay, so you could do a better job yourself, but then how are you going to cope on the foredeck when you have to hand the ship back to the microchips and they let her broach all over the place? Wear a thick pair of gloves when hauling the squeezer down onto the sail. Even with the sheet flying, there's a lot of tension on that thin line. Oh, and by the way, I'm not proud. I pull the squeezer down when the time comes to jibe. It only takes a moment, and makes the whole operation so much more manageable. And if you want to see just how stable a symmetrical spinnaker can be, there's a bit of video on my Old Man Sailing YouTube channel of this particular moment off the west coast of Ireland. Enjoy. Back in the early 90s, when I used to write the Dog Watch column in Yachting World and had just moved aboard for what was supposed to be a lifelong cruise, for what happened to that, see the Old Man's Story pages on the blog. The then editor, Andrew Bray, came up with the idea for a second column, a three-monthly series on the places we visited. It was to be called Passing Through, and the idea was to give a flavour of the ports, the characters, the pubs, the boats, the history, and some pictures, of course. I think it must have run for about 3 years, until we stopped moving and finally gave up the whole thing as a bad job and rented a house. But it was well received while it lasted. Well, I've been looking back over the photos of the week in Galway and thought to myself, that would have made a great passing through. Next thought was how sad it was that there was no point in suggesting to Yachting World that I should start writing again. Yachting magazines aren't what they were. Does anyone read them now? Now it's all video blogs. And then gradually the suggestion filtered through that I had a blog. So, this is Passing Through Galway. You'll like Galway. You don't have a choice. The lock gate only opens for 2 hours on each tide, so once you're in, there's nothing you can do but drink Guinness and listen to traditional Irish music. Actually, I can think of worse ways of spending a week of gales, because that's what we did, my 16-year-old son Hugo and I. His flight out from the UK had been booked for months, carefully scheduled to get him back in time for his GCSE results. And, of course, I had to make darn sure I was there in time to meet him. So I sailed straight from Falmouth, pausing only to wait out a 4-7 headwind in a protected little pool at the entrance to Port Magee Sound. In fact, I arrived early enough to stop at Inishmore, the largest of the Aran Islands. There are two things you need to know about the Aran Islands: Aran sweaters and ruins. Every day the tour boats disgorge swarms of Americans and Italian and, well, tourists from everywhere, and as soon as their feet touch the ground they split up and head off in two different directions. After the cycle hire shop to pedal off to the medieval fortress of Dun Aeneagus, I think it's pronounced, and the other half to the Aran sweater shop. I looked round the sweater shop. After all, I wear a sweater all through the winter, and there are holes in both elbows. However, I couldn't see the beautiful and unbelievably soft woolens on display lasting much past the end of November. So it was off to the fortress. They charged for entry, of course, and the entrance was a 20-minute walk from the fortress itself. Alternatively, there was an award-winning ice cream shop. And anyway, I'd be coming back again with Hugo, wouldn't I? For culture, I pedalled off to the nine churches. It would be easy to miss these. I managed to find two, surrounded by a neat graveyard with Gaelic inscriptions continuing long after the churches had been abandoned. But despite clattering all the way down the track to the sea, there was no sign of the other five. When I got back, feeling a little cheated, there was a minibus waiting. The driver, an obvious character in a baseball cap and a Zabata moustache, sat biding his time while his passengers milled around the ruins. So I asked him for directions to the other seven. "Ah," he says, "there are only the two." "Then why do they call them the nine churches?" "Well, that's just what they called them." I did thinking of asking why, but sometimes in the west of Ireland it doesn't do to ask too many questions. I still had 2 days before Hugo arrived and wanted to look at Samsara's hull. There was a convenient quay at the entrance to the Kinvara River, so there I was in the middle of the night, poking around in the mud beside Parkmore Quay, built with money sent by the people of Canada, apparently, when suddenly there was a hello from the top. Since I might look a bit suspicious, I explained that I would be drying out in the morning and wanted to check that the keel wouldn't be resting on a boulder or something. The pair of dog walkers, as they turned out to be, understood completely. That was their boat out there, the green one. It was pitch dark. In the morning, as I knelt in the mud with a packet of scouring pads and discovered my very expensive copper coat antifouling was falling off, the couple returned. They came down and looked. They were sympathetic about the state of the bottom and complimentary about Samsara's lines, and seemingly on the strength of no more than this, invited me for dinner. Being an Englishman, and not used to invitations from people I hadn't been properly introduced to, I made some excuse. But later, I wondered, had I done the right thing? After all, people were different here. They were friendlier. I called and left a message. And that evening, Anne came and collected me, and I presented her with a bottle of wine that had survived 6 months in the bilges and a loaf of boat bread. And Alan returned from selling a guitar, and another couple turned up, and we had a very convivial evening. It was actually the same in Galway. No sooner had I met the harbour master than he was whisking me off for a Guinness. Well, four, actually. Hugo arrived on schedule, and so did a whole string of Atlantic lows, one after another. Well, if you're going to get stuck somewhere, I used to recommend Dublin. Now I recommend Galway. First, there was the Guinness, which is not the same as it is in England, because they pour two-thirds of it with nitrogen and only the last third with carbon dioxide. Then there is the music. Everywhere in Galway there is music, in the pubs, in the streets. Tig Coily is the famous music pub, but right outside any day you can find the Galway Street Club, a loose group of enthusiasts who play just for the love of playing, although they don't actually do badly out of the equally enthusiastic crowd. On every corner you will find someone with a guitar or a fiddle or just a penny whistle. Some of them barely into their teens, others old and grey and stooping and still going. I was keen that we should see a game of hurling, the peculiar Irish sport, which seems to owe something to hockey, but also to basketball and tennis, with maybe a bit of rugby thrown in, and certainly the egg and spoon race. After messing up the buses, Galway has three bus stations, we took a taxi to the Gaelic Athletic Association's Pearce Stadium and saw Kinvara beat Carn Mór. So narrowly, as it happens, that the final minute had the entire Carn Mór team crowded round the Kinvara goal, brandishing their hurleys in the hope of snatching the vital 3 points. It didn't happen, but it did give a very good impression of what the Battle of Loch Ney must have looked like. This gave us such an appetite for this most exciting but unrecognised sport that we simply had to go and find a spot in the front door pub and watch Tipperary snatch the national title from Kilkenny. And no wonder they wear helmets. There was a day when it stopped raining, although it didn't stop blowing. So we hired another bike from the West of Ireland Cycle Centre, stuffed it in the cargo bay of the bus and set off for the Burren. This is a huge and rocky chunk of landscape on the south side of Galway Bay, which might look pretty barren, but in fact is home to 70% of Ireland's collection of wildflowers. If you're cycling, be warned, it does go up and down a lot. But we stopped at St. Fachnan's Holy Well and dropped a coin in for the GCSE results. We could have taken the old bog road, but there was a small sign saying, "This road is subject to flooding." Well, it would be, wouldn't it? Later, over lunch and more Guinness at Cassidy's Bar, we discovered that the old bog road runs across the bottom of what is Europe's largest disappearing lake, That is to say that it's 5 meters deep when the rain finally stops, and then takes a couple of days to drain away through underground caves and swallow holes before the weather turns soft again. Cycling the Burren was a grand day, as they say over here, apart from one tiny detail. Our bus back to Galway was due at 4:50. By 5:20, the locals who were waiting scattered up and down the pavement, sitting in doorways, poking at their phones, assured us that it would be here directly. Sure, and it's a bit late sometimes. After 3/4 of an hour, when it still hadn't turned up, Hugo and I repaired to the pub opposite, whereupon the bus arrived. The driver, the same one who had taken us on the outward trip, appeared resolutely unconcerned. "Sure, it's a bit busy today," was all he offered. We were too late to get the bike back, but the guy at the hire shop let us off. He was a Londoner, but London-Irish, so that counts. In the end, we did get to sail. There was a 48-hour gap in the weather towards the end of the week, enough to dash over to Kinvara, about 7 miles, take the tide up to the village and go to the pub. The pilot book says, "The passage up should be undertaken with great care and continuous use of the echo sounder." We crept up, just about managing to maintain steerage way, and the tide doing most of the work, our noses pressed to our phone screens and the Navionics app. Of course, after a couple of pints in the Pier Hotel, we went back a lot faster, but then Hugo was driving, exhibiting all the resilience of youth. I missed him when he left. Then Con Brosman turned up from Dublin, half a day late and complaining about the traffic. Con is another rival owner, but his boat seems to have taken root in the yard at Gibraltar, so it was back to Murphy's Bar, and then walking along the pontoon and feeling that Ireland had got the social juices flowing. I stopped in my tracks at the sight of the biggest, most solid, most classically beautiful boat you could imagine. This was Flekkerøy, a 1936 Norwegian pilot boat with not a winch in sight, fabulous woodwork, a 10-foot clinker-dinky stowed on the deck, dead eyes, oh, you name it. And yet there was an enormous Rockner anchor, a full-size Raymarine plotter in the cockpit, modernity where it mattered, tradition where it belonged. Bjørnar Berg and Clara Emmerfors met in a boatyard. He was the mechanic and she was a shipwright. Flekkerøy started life in 1936 as a pilot boat for the island of the same name and carried on in service until 1968. Bjørnar bought her in 2005, and now they have cruised the Shetlands, the Faroes, Iceland, Greenland, Nova Scotia, and all the way down the coast of Canada and the USA to the West Indies. But the Caribbean was not a success. Flekkerøy's 12-metre by 4.5 of woodwork absorbed every joule of heat and promptly released it into the already sweltering cabin. The two Norse people, more used to thick sweaters and 2 heaters for half the year, just couldn't cope with all this, so they headed north again. I asked where they were going after Galway, but they simply had no idea. Nor did they know where they were going to spend the winter. "We'll see," said Bjørnar. "For now we like it here." He had a point. Sometimes you find you've kept a secret for so long that you can't bear to let it go. But today, my new book, Faster, Louder, Riskier, Sexier, hits the Amazon bookshelf. This is a big event for me. It is a book that has been 7 years in the writing. In fact, it was never intended for publication at all. I wrote it as a kind of therapy. I should explain. In 2017, to my shock, at the age of 68, I was told that I had ADHD. That is attention deficit hyperactive disorder. Apparently I'd had it all my life. At the time, when it should have been recognised, nobody had heard of this mental quirk that affects 5% of the world's population. All I knew was that throughout my life, people had considered me odd. At school, they called me thick. Later, people were kind enough to change this to eccentric. It made for an unexpected life, full of wrong turns and bad decisions. Lots of head shaking. If only. To have your life explained to you when you are practically at the end of it can be a crushing emotional experience. The kind lady at the ADHD Foundation proffered a box of tissues and explained that different people deal with it in different ways. Rory Bremner, Paris Hilton, Jim Carrey. Some reach for pills, others head for the therapist's couch. I wrote about it. After a lifetime in newspapers, I write about everything. Over the course of that first year, I wrote the whole story. The disastrous school days, chaotic relationships, the constant search for excitement. I didn't stint, but then nobody was going to read it, were they? This was just as well, because it read like a list of excuses. Also, in retrospect, not only had I messed up my own life, but anyone else's if they were foolish enough or unlucky enough to get close to me. If this was an autobiography, I didn't much care for the central character. But even if I never intended to show it to another living soul, I couldn't leave it like that. If there is one thing that you learn from a lifetime in journalism, it is never, ever to alienate your reader. So I wrote it all again, as if a grumpy editor had thrown it back at me. In the days when copy could be thrown across a typewriter to land fluttering in your lap, I started to look for those parts of the story that might actually be quite fun, if only I could find the right way to tell them. It's what I've been doing for 25 years. Silk purses out of sow's ears were my stock in trade. Just imagine what I could do with a 1950s prep school caning, or fumbling first love in the swinging 60s. There are people today who would not believe you if you told them that you once chased an ambulance on foot, or took a walrus to Greenland with help from the Pentagon. And then there was the load of straw, and the wayward langoustine at the Bulistan. If I could raise a laugh with a long and incident-filled life, then maybe the darker aspects wouldn't appear quite so grim. And so I wrote it all again. And again. And it did turn out to be therapeutic. I went over it once more. And then once more a second time. At the end, there were 6 different versions of faster, louder, riskier, sexier. By the 5th, I had begun to think of ADHD as something to be cherished, a sort of superpower that ordinary people can only dream about. When a literary agent heard me on the Jeremy Vine show talking about spending lockdown sailing in circles around the Atlantic instead of staying at home and shielding like the other 70-year-olds, I was able to gut louder, faster, and turn out old man sailing in a matter of weeks. And still I kept the original hidden away like a guilty secret. But then, recently, the BBC launched an undercover investigation into online ADHD clinics. It seems the condition is now so prevalent that people can wait years for an NHS diagnosis. Alternatively, a 15-minute Zoom consultation and an online payment gets you not only an instant diagnosis, but also the drugs to fix it. Clearly, there was money in this. I looked into it a little further. One of today's most popular podcasts is called You're Wrong About ADHD. This was a hot topic, and I had a book about it. I read it again. I'll make no bones about this. Faster, louder, riskier, sexier, learning to love ADHD is a fantastic book, and I do say so myself. It's funny, it's sad, there's stuff in there you wouldn't believe, and my word, what a life I've had, now I come to read about it. More to the point, the book highlights an entirely new angle on a condition that is ruining the lives of people all over the world. Here's a new message. Don't take psychotic drugs to try and make yourself ordinary. If you've got ADHD, you were never supposed to be ordinary. You're special. Celebrate the difference. So, if you are one of those 1.5 billion people, or if you live with one of them, you need this book. If you just want to laugh out loud at the story of the load of hay, you need this book. You can find it on Amazon. The title again is Faster, Louder, Riskier, Sexier, Learning to Love ADHD, and it's by John Passmore. Frank Sinatra and the Left Flanking Movement. They gave us the finisher's plaque before the start. It was a comforting gesture, full of confidence, rather like sending troops into battle with the medals already pinned to their chests. It was a nice little plaque, too, a plastic tile with ASAB 91 written on it and the boat's name. People would be able to come down into Largo's cabin and say, "Wow, you did the Azores and back." There was a lot of marina credibility in that plaque. So why, as soon as I had peeled off the backing strip, did I know that I had done something terribly, terribly wrong? A shadow passed over the sun. A platoon of departed single-handers tramped over my grave. The boat rocked uncertainly in what ought to have been the calm of Falmouth Harbour. And from that moment on, nothing went right. Take, for instance, the business with the spinnaker. I had spent good money and shed not a few principles in getting a spinnaker squeezer. I was, of course, quite unable to master it, and had to listen to Mary Falk, 5 foot and a smidgen, explaining, "I haven't used one since I gave up on it and cut the endless line off the Muckle Flugger." When you think about it, it's worth doing the round Britain just so you can say something like that. Sure enough, within 2 hours of the start, my endless line wrapped itself endlessly around the squeezer, and then the whole lot wrapped endlessly around the forestay. 10 minutes later, the spinnaker was flying proudly on its own, and the squeezer was stuffed in the forepeak, plotting revenge. This was not long in coming. 100 miles west of Ushant, the tape player packed up. Now, there may be some skippers in the race who would be fazed by the sat-nav going down, or the VMG computer churning out numbers for a night at the bingo, but aboard Largo, with her new waterproof cockpit speakers, the greatest disaster imaginable is Frank Sinatra getting halfway through New York, New York, and then turning into Donald Duck. This meant switching to the spare tape deck. Yes, I do carry one. Even though it meant some ticklish work with the soldering iron as the boat surfed at 7.5 knots. The following morning was warm and calm, and the salt water pump in the galley expired. An hour after that, the galley was in the cockpit. That is to say, I had to take the whole sick unit out to get at the pump, and very soggy and smelly it was underneath. From the log that evening, 1900, Jenny down to number 3 size, lee rail dipping, and we're bashing on at 5 knots plus. I don't much want to go out there, and definitely the sextant doesn't, so we'll have to guess where we are. Since it must be more than 250 miles from the nearest land, does it really matter? Anyway, I've set the decker to look, and it appears to be cruising around the ocean, trying out different possibilities like a dog who knows he buried a bone around here somewhere. The glass started dropping in a purposeful manner. The main sheet parted from the end of the boom, and in among the concerns set up by the howl of the wind, the thump of the bow meeting solid water, and the rattle of spray competing with a downpour, there came the small but unmistakable sound of tearing sailcloth. This would not have happened if I had realized the reefing points should not be tied directly to the dinky little cringles the sailmaker had put in the bottom of the main this year. They properly went back to the pad eyes, riveted to the boom where they belonged. It was later, lying in my bunk, muttering, that another sound came to me, the sound of a small metal object rolling to and fro on deck. It was a very unnerving sound, conjuring as it did images of an errant clevis pin. I looked very hard for this pin. I looked as hard as it is possible to look with a torch through the windows. I looked as thoroughly as anyone could look without actually going out and getting wet. At least I established that the mast was not going to fall down. Indeed, I managed to convince myself that the rattle was really a newly installed shackle, until now not a part of the usual noises of the boat at sea. Wrong. It was the carefully greased screws undoing themselves from the ends of the new full-length battens and dropping like confetti all over the deck and into the sea. If you ever want to know what is the point of having a single sideband radio, it is for moments like this, at the height of a gale, when you can ring up your sailmaker and shout at him. The sailmaker, of course, recommended a more permanent solution than my idea, which involved lots of string. He wanted holes drilled and bolts inserted. People like that should be given a hand drill and put on a coach roof in the middle of a gale to see how long it takes them to drill through their foot. By the time I had removed each plastic fitting, taken it below to the vise clamped to the companionway steps, drilled holes for 8 tiny bolts, fitted the 8 tiny nuts without dropping or swallowing them, I assumed the rest of the fleet was long gone. As if that was not bad enough, when I looked round, most of the crew had jumped ship. There is a tradition aboard Largo that we sail these sorts of races with a geranium aboard. However, after the original died following stalwart service on an Azab and 2 transatlantics, friends became overgenerous with the replacements, until the boat began to resemble a large window box. Well, not by the end of the gale, she didn't. The pot lashed to the afterdeck simply bailed out over the back, and the one wedged over the galley ended up in misery all over the chart table. The sole survivor went brown and seemed to be growing backwards. I went into a decline too, and had to be forced to clean up and listen to a lecture on the benefits of the left flanking movement. The left flanking movement is much talked about in Azab circles and involves a great sweep down the Portuguese coast, sailing many extra miles, but supposedly taking advantage of the Portuguese trades and staying well away from the calms of the Azores High until the last possible moment. At least, that is the theory. From the log. Today I resolved not to spend so much time staring at the ocean. Today I resolved to do things. I began by getting the light headsail up before breakfast and then doing all the washing up. I spent 10 minutes worrying myself sick over a report on the World Service that Alzheimer's disease is caused by overuse of aluminium saucepans. I have nothing else. I even whipped the end of the spinnaker sheet. Am I rewarded for this? Am I hell? We are now progressing in the wrong direction at 2.4 knots. It's that damn plaque, I know it is. And of course it was. For that was when I did what I should have done all that time ago in Falmouth. I jammed a screwdriver beneath the finisher's plaque and wrenched without any thought at all for the damage I might be doing to the bulkhead. The plaque popped off like a jack-in-the-box, and the wind sprang up. Well, actually the wind took another 13 hours to spring up, but the two events were undoubtedly connected, because from that moment on, everything went right. I got the trumpet out of its case. This instrument I have acquired from my 16-year-old son George by the process of premature reverse inheritance, and as Largo sailed westwards, I sat with the score of When the Saints Go Marching In taped to the cockpit cone and blew a series of quite different notes. I have previously maintained that jazz, like Vivaldi, attracts dolphins. I should now record that this is not the case. I have no idea why. After all, when I sailed into Ponta Delgada, last of the fleet, after 14 days, and met Castaway, the Freedom 35 motoring off for a picnic because they've been there so long, I gave them a random rendition, and they were good enough to applaud. Even so, I suppose the early lessons might explain the lack of a pigeon. Everyone else seemed to have given a lift to a racing pigeon. The most spectacular was Charlie, who signed up with the Condor 37 Sally May within sight of Land's End and practically walked ashore at the other end. 2 days after they got in, he was still strutting up and down the pontoon looking for his muesli. Robert Nickerson, the skipper of the 60-foot Panic Major, took a rather different view of his passenger. Robert is a farmer and tends not to get sentimental about livestock. The wretched thing had 3 days' warning. By the time it was 480 miles further from land than when it arrived, and my crew came down saying he couldn't get a grip on deck because of the mess, I took a winch handle to it. Its owner would have wrung its neck anyway. Nothing more useless than a lazy racing pigeon. It was quite a topic of conversation when the fleet was in, that and what happened to everybody's laundry. The last of my smalls arrived half an hour before the restart, along with another commemorative plaque, this one presented by the Club Naval. I hid it in the galley locker, and Largo started with an unexpectedly lucky break. As one of only four boats to take the eastern and meteorologically more dicey route around the island, we carried the wind all the way and ended up careering along under a too big a spinnaker, mostly out of control, and with the log occasionally claiming 8.9 knots. And this went on and on. After 3 days, the overall average was an unheard of 5.3 knots. I began to think that the family wedding I had rather guiltily refused might be a possibility after all. I crammed on all sail. I did things like getting up in the middle of the night to change spinnakers. We chafed through the guy, it was up so long. We pulled the clue out and spent a whole evening sewing it back in. When a gale roared up on the tail, I strapped down two reefs and a pulled-out jib and stood in the hatch mesmerised by the scene as a huge full moon lit up a monochrome seascape with waves blown flat and long streaks of spume stretching all the way to the horizon. I did not, as it happens, get to the wedding. In fact, we crossed the finishing line in Falmouth an hour before the bride reached the altar at Newbury. Largo had managed to cover 1,200 miles in 8 days, 22 hours, 56 minutes. That was faster than the old record. It was so fast that on the return leg, we won on handicap. I would stick the plaque up again, but come the prize-giving, there might be something more spectacular to occupy that space on the bulkhead.